So let's begin with a short meditation just to settle the body, settle the mind, and set a good motivation. So settling the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. So keeping the back nice and straight, and allowing the entire body become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing all the muscles in the face. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allow it to flow naturally. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. can allow your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And now turn your attention to your own mind. Simply observe your own mind. Simply observe as mental events arise and pass, without following them, without trying to get rid of them, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. Now, these mental events can sometimes seem more objective, sometimes more subjective. So things like thoughts and memories and mental images seem more objective, whereas feelings, emotions and moods seem more subjective. So first begin by simply observing the more objective mental events. So that is, focus simply on the thoughts, memories and mental images. And if the mind is still, simply observe the stillness. Simply wait for the next mental event to appear. Now shift your focus to the more subjective events in the mind. That is, feelings, emotions, and moods. So simply observe the current state of your mind. And try to notice if there are any particular mental afflictions present. And of course, if you're feeling frustrated at not being able to focus clearly, then observe that frustration. Or observe that dullness or agitation. Simply observe whatever is present. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Resting in the stillness of awareness. Now, not paying attention to any appearances that arise. Rather, simply resting in awareness itself. awareness that is clear and still. So again, let's begin with a short review. So we're following these outlines from Lamrim Chenmo, from Lama Tsongkhapa. And here we can see that the way in which we can take advantage of this precious human life that we have is that we can make it meaningful at three ever-increasing levels. And at the foundation level, the so-called person of small capacity, then we can make our life meaningful simply by striving for a good future. And the way we can do that is through ethical lifestyle, by abandoning harming others, trying to help others as much as we can, and also purifying our mind of negative habits, negative imprints through the four opponent powers. And so if we engage in these practices, then we'll go a long way to ensuring a good future in this life and then in future lives. But of course, then we can still understand that we are stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara, stuck in this state of dukkha. And so then we can go to the next level, and that is simply not strive for a good future, but strive to break free of this entire cycle. But of course, to even begin to contemplate that, we have to understand the cycle. We have to understand the situation we find ourselves in, that we find ourselves in this state of dukkha, this unsatisfactory state. Because if we don't realize this, then we're still going to continue to look for happiness out there somewhere. But if we can appreciate really the state we find ourselves in, and then if we can go on to understand that the reason we're stuck in this unsatisfactory state is because of our mental afflictions, in particular underlying those, this ignorance, this mistaken view of reality, if we can really appreciate that, i.e. the first two noble truths, and then understand that actually this mind of ignorance and mental afflictions is something we can eliminate from our mind, then we can develop this aspiration of wishing to break free, because we can see why we're stuck and the fact that we can overcome the causes. Otherwise, if we don't do this reflection, then we're never really going to have a genuine wish to be liberated, because we won't understand the cause of our situation and the fact that we actually can. So if we reflect on those two things, the two noble truths, we can then really develop this genuine wish to break free. And a similar presentation we looked at were these 12 links, this wheel of life, which also very clearly describes how we're stuck in this cycle and how to break free. And so these two reflections can really help us to develop this aspiration, this mind intent on liberation, which a little bit unfortunately often in the past has been translated as renunciation. But again, in the Sanskrit word nisarana or the Tibetan word ne chung literally means the mind of emergence, the mind that wants to emerge from this, to be liberated from this. So once we, of course, we've developed that aspiration, then we can strive for the goal of nirvana. And here we saw the three core trainings again were ethics, the foundation, the concentration training to develop a stable, clear mind, and then the wisdom practice. In particular, there the wisdom realizing no self, because it's the overinflated sense of me, we grasp onto that, that creates the mental afflictions. And so by realizing this selflessness, no self, we can overcome the mental affliction, suffering, and achieve nirvana, personal liberation. But as we're going to see shortly in the Vipassana section of the Mahayana that we're looking at now, then this wisdom, this Vipassana practice of no self, actually is not enough to achieve nirvana or enlightenment. We need to understand there's a deeper level of ignorance. The deepest level of ignorance is this grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. And that by realizing there's no independent me, no independent world, we can achieve nirvana. And then in the Mahayana path, then we, with bodhicitta motivation, we can go on to achieve enlightenment. And we'll have a look at that, of course, later. But now we've started to look at the person of great capacity, because at the level of medium capacity, we can understand, well, we're not the only ones who are stuck in the cycle of samsara. Everyone else is as well. So then we can go that step further of not just wishing to liberate ourselves from suffering, but wishing to help liberate everyone else from suffering as well. And so this is the person of great capacity, the person who would then be striving for enlightenment, so that they can be most effective in helping to liberate others from suffering. So this is this bodhicitta motivation. So then that's what we are looking at now, is how to go about cultivating or developing this aspiration of bodhicitta. Because we first have to have the aspiration for enlightenment. Then we can, of course, engage in the practices that will enable us to achieve that goal. And so what we saw here was that the entry point to the Mahayana path to enlightenment, and of course Mahayana, Maha means great, Yana is vehicle. So Mahayana is the great vehicle. It's the vehicle that can take us to the great goal of enlightenment. The entry point then is when we develop this aspiration for enlightenment, for the benefit of others, which is bodhicitta in Sanskrit. And here in this translation, they've translated that as spirit of enlightenment. And so this is the entry point to the Mahayana path. And we saw that the path to nirvana, the entry point for that is when we develop that mind intent on liberation or renunciation. And the entry point into the Buddhist teachings in general, of course, was when we take refuge. And as we're going to later see, at the highest level of practice, this Tantra or Vajrayana level of practice, the entry point to this is empowerment, when we get introduced to the practice through a Tantric master. But we'll talk about a little bit more about that later. So now we're looking at the methods for cultivating bodhicitta. And as we saw in the text yesterday, there are two main methods that are presented. The seven cause and effect, which is where we are now, and the next one, which we're about to begin very shortly, is this method based on the teachings of Shantideva, which is often called this equalizing and exchanging self with others. And we saw that the basis of the seven cause and effect method was to have this mind of impartiality or equanimity. And that within the seven cause and effect method, two of the steps were to develop this great love and great compassion. And so there, when we saw that actually a good basis to begin this cultivation is to develop these four immeasurables. the immeasurable loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. Developing these four qualities to immeasurable sentient beings, or in other words, all sentient beings. So this is a very good basis for us to begin either of these two methods of the seven cause and effect or the exchanging self with others. And also in this method here and in the four immeasurables, again, it's very much recommended that we cultivate these qualities in stages. That, you know, we cultivate loving kindness and compassion in stages. And in particular, if we are not really feeling so good about ourselves, we're suffering from some low self-esteem or self-hatred, then that's where we need to begin. Because if we're not kind and compassionate to ourselves, we're not going to be able to extend it out to others. So then, if we have loving kindness and compassion to ourselves, then we can extend it out in stages. First to people close to us, the friends, then slowly out to people we don't know very well, and then slowly out, start to people who we find a bit difficult, and then eventually to all sentient beings. And this is what's very much recommended here in the Lamrim text as an effective approach. Because again, if from the very beginning we just simply say, may all sentient beings be happy and be free of suffering, it seems like it's pretty easy, because we're not really focused on anyone in particular. So that's why it's very much recommended in this process is to focus initially on particular individuals and then eventually expand that out to everyone. And that'll be much more effective. So then we looked at the seven cause and effect method yesterday afternoon. This was the method that was more widely taught in India and Tibet. But I think in our modern society, this can be a bit problematic because two factors I mentioned yesterday. One was that this method sort of built into the technique is an assumption of a belief in rebirth, which many of us in our modern world do not have. And secondly, the first step of seeing everyone as our mother to develop a sense of closeness. Sometimes we have problems with our mother, so this could make it a bit problematic. But I still think that this can be a very good technique. But what I'd like to do now, of course, is to move on to the second technique, which historically at least was considered too difficult for the average person to implement, too profound, and hence it wasn't, sometimes it's called the secret practice. So it was only taught secretively to those people who could really manage or have the ability to implement it. But I think in our modern society, often this second approach can be much more effective. So let's have a look at what this approach is and how to engage in this practice. So here we see this at the bottom of page 21. And there is three steps mentioned here. But often when this is presented, it's presented with five steps. Because as with the seven cause and effect method, we saw in the seven cause and effect method, also there was an extra step at the beginning to have this impartiality, equanimity towards others. So also here in this practice, then often an extra step is added at the beginning as a sort of a basis for this approach. And that is the step of what's called equalizing ourselves with others, which is very similar to this idea of equanimity. So then it's the full technique then is often called equalizing and exchanging self with others. And so again, the first step here as a preliminary, as a basis for this technique is to equalize ourself with others. And again, the idea here being is that, you know, we may develop this attitude that, you know, everyone is equal, but still there can be this tendency, everyone's equal, but I'm a little bit more important than everyone else, you know, I'm just that little bit more important. So this step here is to try to overcome this, is to really understand that we're all equal in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering, that we're knowing more important than anyone else. And also here, of course, to overcome this biased attitude, feeling close to friends and apathetic to strangers and hostile to difficult people. So that's also, of course, included within this. And then here we see in the text that the first step, it says, contemplating the benefits of exchanging self and other and the faults of not exchanging self and other. So here we are talking about two things. We're talking about the disadvantages of the self-cherishing mind and the advantages of cherishing others. So there's actually two steps here. And the first is the reflecting on the disadvantages of self-cherishing. And here, of course, this word self-cherishing does not mean feeling good about ourselves. Of course, we need to feel good about ourselves. Self-cherishing here is another word for the selfish, self-centered attitude that sees my happiness as more important than the happiness of others. And here, with this second and also the third step, there's a very famous quote here we see in the text there, which says, whatever worldly joy there is arises from wishing for others' happiness. Whatever worldly suffering there is arises from wishing for your own happiness. So this is coming from Shantideva, great 8th century master. And then it says, consider how being self-centered is the door to all suffering and being other-centered is the basis of all excellence. So this is the two reflections, is to reflect on the disadvantages of the selfish, self-centered attitude. Because often we not only feel that it's not a problem to be selfish, but often it seems like this self-cherishing is our best friend, bringing us happiness. And unfortunately, often in our modern society, that's what's promoted. You know, this idea of look after number one, you're the most important person. And then we, of course, follow that idea and we really hold our happiness as more precious than anyone else's happiness. And it seems on the surface that it maybe is our best friend, ensuring that we will be happy. But if we really look at it, it's our worst enemy. Because a number of reasons. One, of course, is that the more we have this self-centered attitude, the more that we get obsessed about me and my happiness and me and my suffering, the more problems we're going to have. Because, of course, if we're obsessed about me and my suffering, then often what happens is people who are highly focused on this develop a lot of fear and anxiety about the world because everything out there is a potential threat. So I better be on guard. So also it becomes very stressful because we can't never relax. We always have to be on guard because even our most closest friends could hurt us. So we better be ready so we can never relax. And then of course to protect ourselves from the supposed threats out there, we often build a big wall around ourselves to protect ourselves. And then so, of course, we cut ourselves off, we get isolated, and a lot of loneliness comes as well. And on the fact of this being very stressful, this approach, you know, we have to always be on guard. Recently, I read there was a very extensive medical study that they did. And I can't remember, it was either in the US or in Europe they did this study. It was very extensive. And the results of this medical study was that people who use the words I, me, and my a lot have a 35% greater risk of heart attack. That was the result of the medical study. So you can see that it's quite stressful. And then, of course, if we become obsessed with me and my happiness, then, and it seems like this happiness is coming from out there, then we often develop a lot of craving for things. And, of course, if we don't manage to get those things, we often get very frustrated. And even if we get them, they never really seem to fully satisfy us. We just end up craving more, 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 more. And then we end up with often a lot of dissatisfaction and even depression when things don't live up to our expectations. So these are a few of the things that can come from this obsessive sense of me and my happiness, me and my suffering. But of course, also with this sense that my happiness is more important than anyone else, then again, we have an exaggerated sense of self-importance. And because of that, then often we show a lack of consideration and respect for others. And then also, when we see others around us who seem to have more than us, we become often very jealous. And then we also become, with the people around us, we often become very competitive with them, trying to outdo them and put them down. And then, of course, if we see those people around us who seem to have less than us, we often become very arrogant and dismissive of them. And then, of course, if someone stands in the way of our happiness, then with the selfish motivation, we would even harm others who stand in the way of our happiness. And so if we harm others in the pursuit of our happiness, then generally they harm us back. And then, of course, we often sort of realize that harming others in the pursuit of happiness is not really the right thing to do. And so then we identify with that, with cognitive fusion, and we end up with a lot of guilt and low self-esteem and self-hatred. So we're sort of like stuck, you know, because we believe that I have to do this to be happy, and yet it's not the right thing to do, and so we punish ourselves, so we're really stuck. And then, of course, as I mentioned yesterday already, with this self-centered attitude, then in every one of our experiences, in every situation we go into, we tend to have a very narrow perspective of that situation. And that narrow perspective is simply, how does this situation affect me? And based on that perspective, again, we categorize people into these three groups depending on how they're affecting me. Friend, if they're supporting my happiness. If the people around us who don't seem to affect me in any way, stranger. And the people around us who seem to interfere with my happiness and even seem to cause me suffering, the so-called enemy. And then, of course, we have very biased attitude to these three groups due to that, because we have then a lot of attachment to our friends because they seem to be the source of our happiness. We end up with a lot of apathy and indifference to strangers because they're not affecting me in any way. And we end up with a lot of hostility, anger, and hatred to the so-called enemy because they seem to be interfering with me and my happiness. And then, of course, when it comes to developing loving kindness and compassion to the people around us, to the so-called stranger, not really, I couldn't care less what happens to them, they're not affecting me. To the enemy, loving kindness and compassion, no way. In fact, I hope they suffer, they deserve to suffer because they're harming me. And loving kindness and compassion to the friend, yes, but only if they continue to say and do things that make me happy. Otherwise, no. So we can see that this self-cherishing mind is really our worst enemy. Even though superficially it may seem like it's really bringing us happiness, it really is giving us a lot of grief. And that is what Shantideva is saying here
Whatever worldly suffering there is arises from wishing for your own happiness. So this wishing for your own happiness, of course, is talking about this self-centered, selfish, self-cherishing mind. So this is the first point to reflect on, the disadvantages of self-cherishing. And then together with that, mentioned here in the same sentence, is to reflect on the opposite, the advantages of cherishing others. And basically, the advantages of cherishing others, of course, is the exact opposite of the disadvantages of self-cherishing. Because if we're having the attitude of cherishing others, it means we're not obsessed about me and my happiness, me and my suffering, which means we're not going to have all this fear and anxiety about the world around us, and we won't be needing to build a big wall to protect ourselves, so we won't have isolation or loneliness, we'll feel much more connected with others. And then, of course, we're not going to be obsessed about me and my happiness, which means we're not going to have so much craving and frustration and dissatisfaction. And also, of course, then we won't have an exaggerated sense of self-importance, which means we will have consideration and respect for others. We won't be jealous of people who seem to have more than us. We'll be rejoicing in that fact. We won't be competitive with others trying to outdo them and put them down. We'll be trying to help them. Likewise, those who seem to have less than us, we won't be arrogant and dismissive. We'll try to help them in whatever way we can. And then, of course, we will not be harming others in the pursuit of our happiness. And also, of course, then, when we enter into a situation, we won't be just thinking, how is this situation going to affect me? Rather, we'll be looking at how is this situation affecting everyone? And therefore, we won't be dividing people into these three groups depending on how they affect us, which means we will be able to develop loving kindness and compassion to everyone, regardless of whether they seem to be providing us happiness or not. So these are the exact opposites, of course, of the disadvantages of self-cherishing. Now, one thing we need to be careful of here, and I think unfortunately it's a trap that people fall into in terms of cherishing others, is the following, and I'd like to talk about that using a concrete example. A few years back, when I was teaching in Tishita in India, there was one student there who had previously come to a course there a year or two before, and he'd heard about this idea. And he was a Danish primary school teacher, and he thought this was a wonderful idea. And so he really wanted to go back to Denmark and really to work on cherishing his primary school children. And he tried to do that, and the result was a disaster. The children started going crazy in class. And then for a while he had a really dilemma, because he really felt cherishing them was the best thing to do, but the result seemed to be a mess. But then slowly he realized that cherishing others doesn't just mean smile and say nice things. Cherishing others means to benefit others, to help others. And so then he understood that if the child starts misbehaving, then he needs to help them to stop that bad behavior. And so then he started to use, of course, compassion for his school children, but if they're misbehaving, not to allow that to happen. So the message here, of course, is that when we are cherishing others, trying to help others, we need to include wisdom. If we don't include wisdom, it will be a disaster, because people are just going to take advantage of us. And this is a dilemma that many people face, is they're really kind-hearted and they try to help others and people just exploit them. But they're really stuck, because they really feel helping others is the right thing to do, but the result is, for themselves at least, not and also for the other person, not good. But then often, unfortunately, what they do is they think, well, then the cherishing others doesn't work, so I better stop doing that. And that's an unfortunate conclusion. The right conclusion, of course, is that we need to make sure we have wisdom when we try to help others. And that if we see others trying to take advantage of our good nature, to not allow that to happen. Because if we really are cherishing others, then if we are allowing them to take advantage of us, we're not helping them. We're actually encouraging them to behave badly. So if we really want to cherish them, we need to be very firm about that behavior. Of course, not cognitive fusion, because then we just get angry with them and attack them. So that's not the solution. Of course, is to, if we see that they're trying to take advantage of us, be very firm about that. Still be compassionate, but be very firm and not allow them to do that. That is the right conclusion.
So it conflict with the saying about impatience. However, people react to you.
Yeah. So patience.
Accept.
No.
No? What's the difference between
No. There's no difference. Is, again, patience.
I just couldn't hear the question.
Yeah, she said there seems to be a contradiction here between what I said and this idea of patience, of accepting suffering and so forth. There's no contradiction. In fact, here, and this is going to come up a little bit later today again, because one of the six perfections we're going to talk about is the patience of accepting suffering. What that means does not mean is if someone is harming us, we sit there and do nothing. This is not what we want to do. This would be irresponsible because we're encouraging them to harm us. So what we need to do and what patience means is to simply not react to that with aggression, aversion, hatred, anger. Patience means simply remain calm and clear. So patience is not a behavior. Patience is a mental attitude. If someone is trying to harm us, simply remain calm and clear. Then we can better evaluate the situation, and then, using wisdom and compassion, if we see that they're engaging in some harmful, unethical behavior, using compassion, try to stop that person from engaging in that harmful behavior. And so what accepting suffering means is that. It means do not react to suffering. It doesn't mean sit there and do nothing, particularly if it's someone else involved. This is irresponsible. We need to not react with hatred and anger. We need to remain calm, see what the situation is, and then use compassion and try to help that person to overcome that harmful negative behavior. That is what it means.
I thought by accepting that behavior, we are cleansing our karma.
We are accepting, but accepting suffering means to not react to it. To not react with aversion. Because if we are suffering, whether it's from someone else or through our own mental afflictions or whatever, if we react to suffering with aversion, the only thing that will happen is it will magnify the amount of suffering we experience. We don't want to self-inflict more suffering than's already there. We do not want that. So that's what it means to accept suffering. And then on top of that, if someone else is involved in the situation, then to use compassion to help that person to overcome their negative behavior. Otherwise, people come up with strange ideas, like I said, someone's harming us. Oh, I have to accept that. I'll just sit there and let them physically beat me up. That's the right thing to do. That would be not the right thing to do according to Buddhism. The wrong thing to do is that. And the wrong thing to do is to react and get angry and harm the other person. Both of these are the extremes. We need the middle way. The middle way is not to react to our suffering, but also to try to help that person in whatever way we can, to stop that negative behavior. That's the middle way. That's what it means to accept suffering and also to cherish others. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Okay, so now not arguing because what you're saying actually makes more sense, but here I can't find it, but I'm coming across Shanti Deva basically saying, if you have to beat me to a bloody pulp, I just hope nothing bad happens to you as a result of you doing that. Or stealing
but,
my stuff, or taking my hands out. Or, he goes through endless examples. You know?
Yeah, but again,
why
here...
That?
Yeah, so that's why we need to understand these sorts of verses. And what he's saying is, do not react with anger. Yeah, that's what he's trying to emphasize. But then often when something like that's emphasized, people interpret that as the other extreme. See, for us, often there's only two options. There's this or this. So when often in a text when it says don't do this, we think, oh, then he's saying you got to do this. But that's not what he's saying. It's just that we don't understand there's a third option. That's why when it's so, and often the reacting with anger is really the heavy one that escalates everything. So there's a lot of emphasis in not doing that and, you know, accepting suffering and so forth. And then because we see that and we only see that this is the other option, we say, oh, okay, then we have to just sit there and let them beat us up. That's not what they're saying. Because we don't appreciate that there is a third option. And the third option is don't react, but don't sit there and let them beat us up. Is to remain calm and clear and try and help that person to stop that negative behavior. But often in these sorts of texts, the more harmful of the two is the first one, the reacting, where we overreact, they overreact, and it gets really just out of control. So both people are engaging in very harmful behavior. And so that's the one that's often addressed because that's the one we often normally resort to. And so they put a lot of emphasis on that. And like I said, when we see a lot of discussion about not doing that, sometimes the way it's worded, we think, oh, I think they're saying we got to do that. No.
I am getting the big picture, it's starting to make sense. But when it gets down to some little
ones, That's why, see, the thing is, texts like that, they're in verse form, so they're very pithy.
Yeah.
And so then we have to unpack it. That's why it's good to get explanations on this. Otherwise, and the translation as well, sometimes.
Here, and they are all very different.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So that's it. So this is where wisdom is important. And I think I mentioned already, we know from our own experience, if someone is preaching to us, even what they're saying is the best thing for us, we will reject it. Won't we? Normally. Unless we're very open-minded. But if someone's really pointing the finger at us, and saying, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that. Even if it's the best thing for us, we often say, no way. Who are you to tell me what to do? So that's why we don't want to do that, because we know that that's not going to work. So that's why we need to use skillful means. We need to try to understand the person's state of mind and try to use language that is not confrontational. And in a situation where that person is out of control, maybe the smartest thing to do is to say nothing and just get out of there for now and then come back when they're settled down and then try to talk to them. But again, wisdom is the key. Otherwise, as you said, it's just not going to work. We do not want to be a preacher. We do not want to, it's not going to work. We're just going to turn people away. And this is one of the pieces of advice I often give at the end of these sorts of courses. You know, sometimes people come to these courses and they get all excited, enthusiastic, and go, oh, my brother, sister, mother, father, cousin, they've got to, this is for them. They got to hear this. Don't go there. Do not go there. Particularly if it's an elder person, like often it's the parent or grandparent who's very stuck. People have this tendency, I've got to tell them about this. This is a solution for them. And then, of course, the opposite happens. The person is quite conservative and you come in there and you sort of bulldoze your way in there and they go, back off. And then any little opportunity you had of getting through to them, you've lost it. So don't go there. Of course, if a person's very open, then you can talk about these things. But again, if they're very closed, if we use the preaching approach, we're going to lose the very small opportunity we had and we won't be able to get it again. So don't do that. So again, one of the best approaches here, lead by example. If we are implementing these ideas ourselves, and this is one of the things we're going to see later in this text here, is the way we can really help people is exactly that, lead by example. Because then they'll see that we're improving as a person, and then maybe they'll go at some point, wow, you've really, you know, improved a lot. You're a lot less calm, less angry. What are you doing, you know? And you're, oh, well, I'm doing this. Oh, really? Maybe I should try that. This is a better approach, I think. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Just one more question. Also, remember that my friend told me to come here. But my question is,
yeah.
Can you tell us briefly who Shantideva was?
Yeah. Shantideva, he was a monk in the monastery in Nalanda, in India, and the other monks thought he was sort of useless because all they saw him do. In fact, he was called the monk who did three things I can't remember the exact term, but basically the monk who did three things. He was known as that. Because all the other monks saw was that he slept, he ate food, and he went to the toilet. That's it. So he was basically sleeping all day. So they thought he was just a lazy nobody who was doing nothing. But actually, he was doing practice dream yoga 24/7. So he was a very high-level practitioner. And then they decided one day they wanted to embarrass him. So they asked him to teach the other monks, or even maybe I think it was the nuns, actually. And then eventually he accepted. And then to embarrass him, they made this very high throne. And usually a throne has steps to go up the side. But they made this very high throne with no steps. And so when he came in to give the teaching, they were hoping to embarrass him. But then somehow all of a sudden he was sitting on the throne. And then like, what's going on here? And then he gave this teaching, this verse and a lot of the quotes in here are from the very same text, this Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, which talks about bodhicitta, and then it talks all about these six perfections that we're going to be covering the rest of today. So then, of course, he's very famous for that. And it's said that when he, in the later part of his teachings, when he started to talk about the wisdom practice, the emptiness practice, it said that he sort of levitated and disappeared.
Teaching came out of the air?
Well, something like that, yeah. I mean, it's different, different stories. Okay, so the fourth step here now relates to the second point here at the bottom of page 21. It says, the ability to exchange self and other if you have accustomed yourself to doing so. So having reflected on these two, the disadvantages of self-cherishing, advantages of cherishing others, then we can really come to this conclusion that we can really do that if we simply accustom ourselves to that difference, to the advantage, to the cherishing of others. So this is the fourth step. And as with every practice, of course, for it to really be effective, we need two components. We need some meditation practice, and we also need to practice it in daily life, to really practice this exchanging self with others in daily life. And I have a quote here, quite well-known quote, which is a very good example of how to practice this in daily life. And it goes like, this is the quote here now. When I am hungry, give me someone that I can feed. And when I am thirsty, give me someone who needs a drink. And when I am cold, give me someone to keep warm. And when I grieve, give me someone to console. So that's from Mother Teresa. So I think she was quite good at this. And another very short quote that I like, a one-line quote, is, "Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile. Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile." So that comes from Albert Einstein, so maybe he was onto something as well. In terms of meditation practice, we can talk the next outline, outline three, that goes over onto the next page. And the meditation practice is the one that I've been doing a little bit with you this morning and yesterday, this idea, this practice of Tonglen. And Tonglen is a Tibetan word which literally means giving and taking. And so here the idea being that we imagine taking the suffering of others and we imagine giving our happiness away to others. And this visualization of doing this is very powerful because the last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to take any suffering from anybody. And the last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to give any happiness to anyone. So this imagining doing this really crushes the self-cherishing mind and increases the mind of cherishing others. And again, normally with this practice, the same as with the loving kindness and compassion practice, we do this in stages, and that's what we've been doing a little bit in some of the meditations, is what's often said is first start with someone close to you. Then once you're comfortable doing that, then to people you don't know very well, then start to pick some people you find a bit difficult, and then eventually you can expand it out to everyone, all sentient beings. But again, if we are suffering from guilt, low self-esteem, self-hatred, start with ourselves. Do this practice with ourself first, to develop loving kindness and compassion for ourself first. Now, how to do this meditation, there's a number of ways. Often here, the more traditional way that is explained is a little bit different than what I've been leading today and yesterday. So maybe I'll explain that first. So the more traditional way is as a little bit like we started, is imagine the person in front of you and imagine that whatever suffering or mental affliction that they have, imagine that in the form of black smoke filling their body, and then really have this wish that they may be free of that. And then this Tonglen meditation is often mine's gone blank. It's often recommended that we do this meditation conjoined with the breath because it helps us to focus. So what's recommended then is that when we visualize this black smoke in their body, then using the in-breath, we imagine drawing the black smoke out of their body. And often the way it's explained is that when we're learning this process, first use four or five breaths to draw it out and imagine that it collects in a little cloud in front of your face. And then the way it's normally presented is that at that point, then imagine your selfish, self-cherishing mind as a small, hard, black rock in the center of the chest. And then using one in-breath, draw in the black smoke, imagine it comes down, it touches the black rock, and then both are completely destroyed. So this is normally how the first part is explained. And then the second part is then imagine all your happiness and qualities in the form of a white light in the center of the chest. And then using the out-breath, and first again having the wish for them, you know, may they be happy and have the causes of happiness. And then using the out-breath, imagine breathing out that white light. And imagine that then it transforms into everything they need to be happy. And again, when we're learning this, using a number of breaths to send that out. So this is the way that it is normally presented. But I prefer the sort of slightly different way that I've been leading. And again, one of the main reasons is that in our modern society, we're so much focused on the negative, and that we also then focus on the negative with cognitive fusion. And so therefore, often when it's explained about the black rock of self-cherishing here, then when people visualize that, then they often identify with that. And that's not very helpful. Of course, we're not supposed to do that, but that's often our habit. You know, when they visualize that, they hold on to that. Or when the black smoke comes in, they hold on to that, identify with that. So that's, of course, cognitive fusion. That's not very helpful. That's why, personally, I think can be a better approach is to start with this purity of mind, the deepest level of our mind, as a white light in the beginning phase, because then we can start to identify with our inner qualities rather than our mental afflictions and suffering. And also, of course, both approaches are very symbolic, because this white light in the initial phase, this Buddha nature, is our inner wisdom. And it's actually our inner wisdom that dispels self-cherishing and mental afflictions and suffering. So that's symbolized by the black light being dispelled within the light. So, again, personally, I prefer to use that approach, but often you'll find the other explanation used and also used. So you can use whichever approach works best for you. And again, with the visualization, you know, often people have difficulty with clearly visualizing things. But again, with this practice and all these sorts of visualization practices, the more important than having a super clear visualization is more important is this sort of feeling of wanting to take the suffering and give the happiness. That's the key. We can have super fine visualization and mechanically go through the process with excellent visualization and not really have much effect. So again, the more important thing is that to imagine really wanting to take that suffering from them and wanting to give the happiness to them. That's the key element. Of course, if you can have good visualization, that can make it more powerful perhaps. But again, that's the key element. Now, when this meditation is often described, then often there's a few doubts or even some sort of anxiety about the meditation. Because, you know, often people then think, well, if I've got someone in front of me that's got some sort of serious illness, and I imagine taking that on, well, I might get sick. I might get that illness. So, of course, that's not the case. Remember, we are simply imagining this, visualizing this, so we can't take their sickness on. But then when that's explained, then people then go, well, what's the point of doing this exercise if I can't take anything away from anyone? Again, the main point of this exercise, of this meditation, is to reduce and eliminate our self-cherishing mind and to strengthen our mind of cherishing others, to strengthen our loving kindness and compassion. Which means if we're doing this meditation in a heartfelt way, it means that after the meditation in daily life, we'll be helping others in a more pure way. I mean, now we may help people close to us, but even the people close to us who we help, often we have our own agenda, you know, or I know best. This is what you need to do. So often our self-cherishing interferes with us effectively helping people close to us. And then, of course, people we don't know very well or people we don't like much helping them? Ugh, not really. So if we really do this practice well, we're going to help our friends in a more pure way for their sake, not because I know best or this is what you have to do, because this is, I think, what you have to do. We'll be helping them in a more pure way, and then we'll start to want to be helping other people around us as well. We'll have that. So this is going to be this is the main goal of the meditation. But also on top of that, we need to realize that the power of the mind is immense. And there, I think, are some scientific evidence to support this, in that we can, if we do this in a heartfelt way mentally, we can have a direct positive impact on that person's mind, even if they're on the other side of the planet. And there is some scientific evidence to suggest that this is possible. So we should not underestimate the power of the mind. And we can sort of know this in a very simple way, in that when someone walks into the room who is radiating love and compassion, without them saying anything, they can have a very positive impact on our mind. So we can have this subtle impact, particularly if we have a connection with that person. So, and other studies have shown as well, is if we're doing this for someone else, that, and this is not a Buddhist thing, but this is just through modern studies, is that if we're doing this practice for others, it's probably better not to tell them we're doing it. Because modern studies have shown, and again, this is typical of our modern mentality, is if we tell them we're praying for them or doing something for them, then they often feel like there's some expectation on them. And so modern studies have shown that if you tell people that you're praying for them or doing something for them, it actually has, on average, a slight negative impact. Modern studies have shown that. But, of course, that's just through our own thinking, you know. So, again, better to not maybe tell people. Again, that's nothing to do with Buddhism. That's just modern studies and our modern attitudes to these sorts of things, which is, again, very unfortunate that on average, when people hear that someone's trying to pray for them and help them, they end up with a negative state of mind. I mean, that's very sad. But seems like that's the case in our modern society, unfortunately. Any questions on this Tonglen meditation?
Small children who are going through the same thing. And it helped with my self-cherishing mind. I felt like, oh, I'm the only one. This is such a heavy weight to bear. So when I opened it up, then I realized, oh, I'm not alone. And
yeah.
So the self-cherishing also helps us in that way to let go of that.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the next point I was going to mention, is that this Tonglen practice, we can also use it in our own life when we are faced with difficulties, maybe some sort of illness or even a mental affliction. Because again, if we have some illness or mental affliction arising in our mind, we go, oh no, not that again, go away, go away. And we develop aversion to it, you know. Like the classic, of course, is that we have some anxiety and then we get worried about the anxiety and then, of course, it sort of like gets huge. So here then, and this is very much one of the practices that's very much emphasized in this Lojong system of practice, which also Lama Ratisha introduced into Tibet, of taking these adverse conditions into the path, meaning that if we ourselves are having some sort of physical illness or we ourselves are getting caught up in some mental afflictions, to take that opportunity instead of wallowing in our self-pity and having aversion and magnifying suffering and self-cherishing, you know, poor me, poor me, poor me, rather than, as we're going to see, accept the suffering. But, of course, accept suffering doesn't mean don't try to overcome it. Because so if we've got a physical illness, we're not saying don't try and cure it. What we're saying in accepting suffering is don't react to that with aversion, because that's just going to magnify suffering. So then we can, in that situation, then, as you said, think, well, I'm not the only one that has this illness, or I'm not the only one who's caught up in anxiety or anger or whatever at the moment. There must be thousands of other people in the planet, similar issues, maybe much worse. So therefore we can use this Tonglen practice of taking on that from others and giving them happiness. And in that way, we can use this difficult situation to not get caught up in self-cherishing and magnify our suffering, and at the same time, use this situation to really develop loving kindness and compassion for others. And often then that attitude even overwhelms some of the discomfort we normally would feel. And then, of course, we can have a positive state of mind. And now I think there are a lot of studies, modern studies, to show that that has a huge impact on being able to cure ourselves from various illnesses, you know, that it really boosts the immune system. And there have been many cases of people doing this and actually curing themselves as well. So there can be also this added benefit as well. But at least what we can achieve is to not to self-induce a lot of unnecessary suffering, and then to be in this very heavy negative state of mind saying, poor me, poor me, poor me, and thinking we're the only one who's suffering on the planet. So I think this is a very good point.
This is a really good point for mothers who feel they can't slow down, they have a family to take care of, cannot deal with this illness, pushing it away. It sounds very practical.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's very, very practical advice, I think.
That's what really appeals to me. It's like Jesus said, you know, do unto others, you know, and all that, but this is like the practical way to go about doing that. Yeah. It's like somehow maybe that wasn't a Christian tradition, they got lost on the way. All I got was the conclusion. Mm-hmm. But here in Buddhism, I got like the program.
Yeah, I think that certainly within Buddhism, and particularly I think Tibetan Buddhism, a lot of these various practices are presented very clearly. Yeah. I think probably if we dig deep enough in most other religions, they're there somewhere, but we have to dig and find, and not so easy, and often not very clearly explained what to do. Whereas here in Buddhism, and really the Tibetan Buddhists were very good at this, is really making everything very crystal clear. So we can benefit from that, I think. Okay. Okay, let's break there for a morning tea break. We'll come back, and then we'll move on to how we go about then really working with this mind of bodhicitta that we're developing through these two practices, how we use that as a basis for the practices on the Mahayana path. So that's what we're going to start to look at after the break. Let's take a break first.